My guests for the second segment of the show today are the Reverend Dr. Holly Beaumont, who's a retired Disciples of Christ minister and director of the Interfaith Worker Justice New Mexico, which is the state chapter of a national organization, and the Reverend Dr. Harry Eberts, the current pastor of First Presbyterian Church, the church that everybody knows your church, the church that sits catty-cornered on Grant Street downtown. Reverend Eberts' congregation is one of the most active in town in terms of social justice, I think I can say. And I know this firsthand because Friday mornings I'm down at the Interfaith Shelter and the kitchen crew is from First Pres. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So when we say we're going to talk about social justice legislation, what are we talking about? What does that encompass?
It encompasses the biblical mandate to not only feed the hungry and house the homeless and care for the suffering, but to also address and reform public policies that create the hungry and the homeless and the suffering. And both of those are clear biblical mandates.
And you're saying biblical, and so that would mean Judeo-Christian. But
that would mean the Abrahamic traditions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam.
Uh-huh. And what about other religions? Don't you think that...
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, interfaith worker justice is very inclusive, very interfaith, and we find that virtually all world religions are grounded in the same core values that encompass social justice.
Which include, what's that wonderful Old Testament quote about taking care of the widows? And here you guys are. You're supposed to be able to just spout that stuff, right?
It's in the Old Testament.
Right. So sometimes I think we assume that when we talk about social justice issues that there's a partisan flavor to that. Is that true? Are social justice issues always falling into the Democratic category as opposed to the Republican?
Oh, we always hope not. We always hope that everybody has a sense that we need to help each other out to have compassion in this world, and that if things aren't working for all of us, it's not working for any of us. And so I hope that it spans all ideologies.
So the people that you interact with on some of these issues come from both parties or perhaps are independents?
Well, no doubt about it. In fact, I'd never even know in my congregation who would be called Democrat or Republican or independent. That's not the issue.
Mm-hmm. The issue is taking care of people.
Exactly.
Have churches and religious people always been as involved in what we call social justice issues as in the past? You know, when I was growing up, I don't remember hearing about things like that, except for very basic things like, you know, money in the offering plate on Sunday that would go to a good cause.
You know, well, when I was growing up, that was very much the focus of the mainline Protestant denominations. I think we were at our best during the 60s and 70s. And we were so effective, in fact, that when the neoconservatives were sort of deciding what their strategy was going to be for redirecting the policies of this nation, they understood that they were going to need to discredit the mainline Protestant denominations. And that's when a lot of these schisms popped up in each of our churches, and they were heavily funded by neoconservative and groups, and it was very effective. And if you look at the mainline Protestant denominations now, for example, Disciples of Christ, we had a vibrant Department of Church and Society that is gone because it was under attack by the schisms. In ours, it was called Disciple Renewal, but it was an extreme right-wing group that really sort of infected the denomination. And of course that also happened in the Presbyterian Church and the Lutheran Church and the Episcopal Church.
Right. We were taken off track for a while, and I hope that we have our voice back now, or at least getting a stronger voice in these issues.
So talk to me about some of the issues that are going to come up in the legislature. Talk to me about bills that you are for. Holly, why don't you get started and jump in, Harry, whenever you want to.
Well, I wanted to highlight some bills that we're particularly interested in, one of which is the loan interest rate caps, and that seeks to set a cap on interest that predatory lenders or payday lenders can set at 36% rather than 300% or 400% as it is now. And, when I talk to people about that, they'll say, why 36%? That seems too much. And the truth is, it is too much, but it's the best that we can do. I was reading op-ed from Steve Fishman. He's the former senator from Las Cruces who is spearheading this campaign. And in this, he talks about the fact that currently there are 684 small loan licenses in the state of New Mexico, that in fact there are more loan shark outlets than fast food chain restaurants in New Mexico.
Wow. Huh. And most of these, and these are the places where if you're having a bad month, you've run out of money, you can go sign over your car title, right, to get a loan or otherwise get a loan because you do have a regular job, but then they're not charging a normal loan fee like a bank would.
Right. And another bill that we have been supporting and introduced over the last few years is the Wage Theft Prevention Act. And wage theft plays right into the predatory lenders, because if you don't get paid for work completed, then you have no capacity to honor your family budget, including the gas you need to put in your car, the rent that is due yesterday. And so then you're looking around for some way in which to meet those immediate needs, and it very often ends up turning to a predatory lender. And once you get hooked into that system, it's almost impossible to get out.
And then they'll loan you more money, and it will just kind of...
Well, you just spend, the rest of your time trying to pay off all that interest.
Right, uh-huh. And so explain a little more about wage theft, because it's a phrase that I think is kind of complicated, actually.
Yeah, it is pervasive is what it is. And there's an excellent article, actually, in a recent issue of the Santa Fe Reporter. They've been doing some excellent investigative reporting on this issue. And the title of it is Payday. And they talk about the fact that here in Santa Fe, for example, where we have the highest minimum wage, one of the highest in the country, enforcement has been the weak link. And enforcement has been the issue for workers on many levels. And so the article demonstrates that many workers in Santa Fe, and of course many workers across New Mexico and indeed the nation, are simply not getting paid for work completed. And that can be that they're not getting paid whatever the minimum wage is, they're not getting paid overtime, they're being required to work off the clock. An example would be a restaurant that says, we want you to get here an hour before your shift so that you can set up, or we want you to stay an hour after your shift so that you can clean up. And so workers are just sort of not being paid for the work that they've completed in good faith. And this puts them... There's another issue of wage theft that's pretty pervasive, and that is flex. It's called flex hours, and it means that workers don't know from shift to shift how many hours they're going to be allowed to work. And Walmart is one of the perpetrators of this. So it means that it's almost impossible for workers to budget, to know what their family budget can sustain, because they don't know how many hours they're going to be allowed to work from week to week.
And they can't get a secondary job, maybe.
And right. Very good point, Hollis. They can't get another job because they have to be available to work whenever they're allowed to work.
Whenever the boss
And sometimes
calls.
These people will actually travel a distance and arrive and be told, we don't need you until, 3 hours from now, or we don't need you at all today.
Mm-hmm. Go home.
Go yeah. home. Mm-hmm.
And so what will the wage theft protection law do?
Well, part of, New Mexico was one of the first states to actually pass a state wage theft law. That was back in 2009. The problem was there were actually two bills, and the bill that got passed protected workers, but the bill that didn't get passed had the teeth and for enforcing it, and it included penalties for business. So part of what we're doing now is strengthening the existing law by adding the teeth, as we refer to it.
And so does that involve fines for employers
it does.
Who violate the law?
It does.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the previous law didn't do much good when there was no ability to enforce it.
Well, it did good. Yeah, it did fine if we had regulatory agencies that were willing to enforce the law, and of course we don't have that. Department of Workforce Solutions has a very mixed record on enforcing and regulating wage laws the way they are intended. And it's been a constant frustration, particularly under this administration.
Right. And I just want to add on the wage theft issues, one of the other ways that employers sometimes steal the wages of their workers is by taking their tips.
Absolutely. Yeah. Workers are not getting their tips. Yeah. And so what we want to say is the wage theft has a negative impact on all of us, because when workers don't get paid, the rest of us don't get paid. And that means they're not spending their wages in the local economy. Right. So it really does have a ripple effect.
And they're becoming more dependent upon charitable
Absolutely. Then they're turning to charitable organizations and public services.
Right.
And this is, you know, against their better interest and against their will.
Right.
These are people who are working to sustain themselves and their families and are being cheated out of their wages.
Thanks, Holly. Harry, do you want to tell us about something you're concerned about?
Sure, yes. I'm part of the New Mexicans of Gun Safety. It's a group that started right after Sandy Hook, and we are behind a bill, HB 44, which we were part of back in 2012. It's a bill put forward by Representative Miguel Garcia. And we got it all the way to the final half hour of the session 2 years ago, and then it was filibustered. And so we're coming back with that bill again. And that bill simply states that we are calling for background checks on individual non-licensed firearm vendors at gun shows. And so we don't have any kind of current law that does that right now. So you can go to a gun show right now and buy any firearm without any background check, and you can walk off with it.
If I go into a store, what happens?
And a store is under a different rule, and so they have to be licensed. And what that does, though, a gun show versus a store, it sets up really unfair competition, because why would someone would have to go through a gun show and a store? Go to a gun show. Don't go to a store. The stores are losing out economically on
so
this
issue.
So if
you go to a store, they do have to run a background
yes,
check.
Yes, they do.
And that takes a little time, and it's kind of a pain. And if you're a bad guy, well, you don't want to do that. Whereas if you can go to a gun sale, one of these things they do, there's nothing. You just go up, give
no
your money,
questions
walk
asked.
Away with a gun.
Some do, but many don't have to. They don't have to. And so we are saying that this is a real issue. There's too many guns already that are getting in the hands of people that should not have them. In fact, New Mexico is the 10th highest state for gun deaths, just so you're aware of that. And also, it ranks 7th highest for women being killed, and the majority by firearms. Governor Martinez has a lot of photo opportunities with children, but children in New Mexico are killed by guns at a rate 60% higher and murdered at a rate 40% higher than the national average, killed by guns. And so we need to stop that. One death is one too many. And so our group and Miguel Garcia and others who are supporting this are really working hard, hoping that we can be a state that really does cherish its people, its children, its youth, its adults.
Are there people on both sides of the aisle who will support this law?
There are some.
Uh-huh.
In fact, we were heartened at the last session 2 years ago that there were a number of Republicans that supported this law. But as I said earlier, by the time we got to the last half hour, there was no chance for a debate. It was filibustered. And so the whole the legislature had no chance to really talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so we hope this year they will, mm-hmm. and that they'll bring it up and get through committee.
And is there any support from the gun stores?
You know what? There are a few supporting organizations. The National Alliance of Stocking Gun Dealers and the Bull Moose Sporting Alliance support background checks for the sale of all guns at gun shows. Mm-hmm. So there are groups that are about guns that are supporting this. They realize the importance of it.
They're not the hardliners who say any law that controls guns is anti-gun. They're coming to grips with reality.
And we hope that we can bring both sides together on this. And we're not going to go anywhere unless we have a chance to talk with each other and actually know each other by name.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we can move forward with that relationship.
Thanks, Harry. Holly, what else have you got on your list?
Well, I just want to say a couple of words about Miguel Garcia, because he is the sponsor not only of the gun law, but also of the Wage Theft Prevention Act. And I want to point out to people that there are a lot of politicians out there that are terrified of supporting gun control or gun safety bills because they think it's political suicide. And Miguel Garcia was handily reelected in his district during this last session. He's from Albuquerque.
Uh-huh.
And this gun bill, gun safety bill, is the first legislation that's been introduced at the state legislature in 10 years. That was 2 years ago. So we want to commend Miguel Garcia for his leadership.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a courageous leadership at that.
It is.
Yeah, there are a couple other bills that I think are particularly interesting this year. One is the Patient Safe Staffing Bill that's being introduced again by Christine Christine Trujillo, Representative Christine Trujillo, which would seek to require every hospital in the state to do what we just succeeded in requiring Christa St. Vincent to do, and that is to have staffing guidelines and to hold the hospitals accountable for maintaining those staffing ratios between patients and nurses and medical staff. So we're very interested in that. And then there's another one that's the dental therapist licensure, and that's a bill that creates a new level within the dental care community called dental therapists. And New Mexico, a lot of people don't realize this, but New Mexico is one of the states that has a serious shortage of dentists and dental care. And that's a life and death situation. I don't think people understand that cavities are contagious. The bacteria that causes cavities can be transmitted from one person to the next orally or with, you know, sharing a spoon or sharing food or even kissing. So parents can transmit cavities to their children just with physical contact. That was something that I've learned from healthcare or Health Action. And the only opposition there is to this is the New Mexico Dental Association. And they're a very powerful group, but we think that we can persuade the legislature to support this. And I just want to historically note that the dental associations across the country also opposed creating dental hygienists. And for anybody who has been to their dentist, you know that most dentists now rely on dental hygienists, almost, you know, to a great extent. So this is just sort of knee-jerk opposition, and we think we can get past it.
And that's a dental therapist is analogous to perhaps a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner.
That's a great analysis.
They can do a lot of the things
right.
that the dentist can do, but not everything.
And what's exciting about this is that the approach is that communities support candidates to go to our community colleges who are going to offer the training program, and then they return to their communities to provide this. So we're actually looking at creating jobs in some of the rural communities that need jobs.
And also, I mean, New Mexico has always had a problem with having qualified medical care and dental care in the rural areas. And so if you had, for example, say you're a dental practitioner in Farmington and you also practiced out in one of the further rural communities, you could have a dental therapist out there kind of running the practice under your supervision, and then the dentist could just go out one time a week. In other words, any way you cut this, it's going to improve dental care for rural New Mexicans especially.
And you make a good point. These dental therapists will be supervised by a dentist.
Right. Yeah. So that's a good one. What else?
Well, there are a couple of things that we're working against, and one of them is called the Employee Preference Act, which is coded language for right to work, which is coded language for undermining the effectiveness of unions. You know, when a business becomes develops a union, it's done by a democratic process. The employees vote for collective bargaining and to establish a union. So Right to Work, which is being called this session Employee Preference Act, undermines unions by allowing employees to work for a union shop without joining the union. However, the union is required to negotiate on behalf of all employees, whether they're union members or not. So
the person who doesn't pay union dues would get the same benefits as other employees.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly.
And so how would this work exactly? They would just no longer be required to pay dues, so people could drop out of the union at will.
Right. Uh-huh. Right.
And what's the concern about that? Some people would say, well, unions have run their course in so many fields and.
Well, obviously unions, you know, that is a misperception that unions have run their course. And what we know is that the economy in this country was at its best when we had strong unions. And Detroit and the automobile industry is a great example of that. And, you know, when those employers and businesses and corporations decided that they wanted to increase their profits, they began to look at ways to reduce wages. We talk in this country about worker productivity is at an all-time high, and how proud we are of that because American workers are so productive. What that really means is that there are so many positions that have been eliminated, so that most workers are doing the job that was previously done by two people or three people, and it's creating a climate, a workplace climate that is stressful and unmanageable. It's just creating great problems for workers. So workers' wages are not going up, but the amount of work they're being required to do is going up, and it puts it's a risk to their health and their safety and their well-being.
I heard some statistics recently, you know, when those reports came out about the economy last week. It was talking about how much real wages had increased or not in years past. And, you know, I looked at, there was some statistics about, you know, actually you were making more money in 1987. And I looked back, and looking at my own life in 1987, I do this all the time. I'm sure other people do too. They look back and they think, how was it that I was living so much better then, you know, than I am now? And it is because that, you know, wages are not keeping up with inflation and everything else in our economy.
You know, we forget, and sometimes when I do presentations, I'll ask people, when was the last time that the federal government raised the minimum wage? And of course, that was in 2007, and they raised it to $7.25. Now, our state minimum wage is $7.50. But I'll ask them, what was the federal minimum wage before they raised it to $7.25? And we're talking about just a few years ago, and it was $5.50. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, try to imagine supporting yourself on that kind of a minimum wage.
Right. Yeah, and that is what it is because of the changes in the economy and the inflation. We aren't making what we used to think of as that $10 an hour is simply not $10 an hour anymore.
Right. So yeah. Costs have gone up. Right. Everything has gone up except for wages.
Right. Is there any other...
Well, we want to plug our Witness for the People, which
yeah.
is, this will be the fifth year that Interfaith Worker Justice New Mexico has worked with congregations like First Presbyterian Church and the Interfaith Leadership Alliance to organize an event that takes place on the opening day of the legislative session in the Rotunda. It's going to be at 3 p.m., and it's timed to take place just after the governor has had an opportunity to present her State of the State address, and this we call the People's State of the State address. So it's our opportunity for faith leaders, clergy and laity, to gather and to announce our own concerns about what the legislature and the administration need to be focused on and accomplished during this session.
And Holly, you were talking to a group of clergy yesterday about how this, the attitude that you take in this is not one of saying, dear legislators, please help us. Explain that.
Yeah, that's very important. Thank you. We don't consider ourselves beggars. The scriptural passage that's the theme for this year's event is the very familiar passage from Proverbs, and it's, where there is no vision, the people perish. And so our challenge to the legislature and the governor is to say, what is your vision for lifting the people of New Mexico out of poverty and despair? And what is your vision for protecting our environment and building a stronger economy, providing children with hope for the future? We live in a state that is rapidly being changed from the land of enchantment to what I call the land of economic and environmental devastation. And the latest stats are that people are leaving New Mexico. They're not coming. So we really are a state that's at risk for perishing on many important levels. And our special guest for this event is the Reverend Dr. James Forbes, who is the Minister Emeritus of Riverside Church in New York City. He was the first person of color to be the senior pastor of that congregation, that great historic congregation. His predecessor was Reverend William Sloan Coffin, who was an amazing activist. And he's I want Harry to talk about the other event that he will be providing leadership for here in Santa Fe on that Tuesday.
Right, on Tuesday evening, 7 o'clock at the First Presbyterian Church, Dr. Forbes is giving a presentation on really nonviolence and how to live that in this state, in the world, and economically, environmentally, between people, all sorts of ways that we can understand that nonviolence is our way of getting out of a lot of these issues that we're talking about, and it's our vision. And Dr. Forbes has been noted as one of the greatest preachers in the English language, and so I invite everybody to come, not only to 3 o'clock at the Roundhouse, but also our church that evening at 7 o'clock to hear him speak. It'll be a real treat.
Great.
Thanks. Yeah, in 1996, Newsweek magazine recognized Dr. Forbes as one of the 12 most effective preachers in the English-speaking world.
There you go. There you
go.
Wow.
We're very excited to have him.
I'm very excited to meet him. And so the event, Witness for the People, is at 3 o'clock on Tuesday, January 20th, which is the opening day at the legislature.
Yes.
And
in the rotunda.
In the rotunda. And so people are invited to come to support this idea of challenging our legislators and the administration to improve our state and to use our resources to better the human
condition
here.
Absolutely.
Right? And so there'll be some kinds of prayers from various clergy. And
well, the program is going to include a blessing by Kathy Sanchez with Tewa Women United. We have a wonderful poet from Santa Clara Pueblo, Beata Sosi Pena, and we have music that's going to be presented by the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Santa Fe. The theme song is Imagine by John Lennon.
And everybody can sing along.
And everyone can sing along. And then there will be prayer petitions from people of faith, and we are planning on presenting those prayer petitions, which really is, you know, saying we require this legislature, we call this legislature, we don't beg this legislature. We tend to remind them that they are, in fact, public servants who are in that position because they've been put there by the people of New Mexico who they are called to serve.
And Reverend Dr.
And then Dr. Forbes will give he will be the key speaker for that event. Mm-hmm. And we really want everyone to come out and help us fill that space. You know, this event predates the Moral Mondays in North Carolina, and I will say that it was an idea that I picked up from other faith communities in states across the country who really felt it was important for people of faith to be present on the opening day of their legislators to raise their voices and be sure that they're heard.
And show up, yeah.
Yeah.
To show up. I wanted to mention while we're talking about this that there's a grassroots lobby training that's going to be going on Wednesday, January 21, 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Whole Foods, where some sponsoring organizations ranging from the Sierra Club to America Votes to the Albuquerque Federation of Teachers, they're coming together to teach ordinary folks how they can be effective in lobbying their legislators. So I encourage you all to go check that out as well. Thank you, Holly.
Thank
Beaumont,
you, Hollis.
And thank you, Harry Ebert, two of the most effective social justice workers in our clergy community here.
Thank you
so much for being with me.